Welcome to the Just and Sustainable Economy Podcast. I'm Isaac Graves. Today we're bringing to you a conversation recently held at our annual conference on regeneration, featuring the president and CEO of Indian Collective, Nick Tilson, in dialogue with ASBN's co-founder and president, David Levine. Nick Tilson is a citizen of the Oglala Lakota Nation. Tilson has over 18 years of experience building place-based innovations that have the ability to inform systems change solutions around climate resiliency, sustainable housing, and equitable community development. He founded Indian Collective to scale these place-based solutions while building needed philanthropic, social impact investment, capacity, and advocacy infrastructure geared towards building the collective power of Indigenous peoples. Tilson has received numerous fellowships and awards from Ashoka, Rockefeller Foundation, Bush Foundation, and the Social Impact Award from Claremont Lincoln University. He has an honorary doctorate degree from Sinte Gleska University. You're in for a real treat today. Nick, David, take it away.
My name is Nick Tilson, a teacher in my Lakota language. Honored to be with you here on the lands of the Lahoya people. And part of the community here. I come from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. I live in the Porcupine community, my home community on Oglala, Lakota. And I basically kind of came into this work. My grandfather was a civil rights attorney who represented the American Indian Movement when it was first getting started in the streets of Minneapolis, when the Native community was policing the police in the Franklin Avenue area of Minneapolis, and who really aimed to took a page out of the book of the Black Panther Party and started just protecting their own communities. And so some of the first lawsuits that were filed on behalf of the American Indian Movement were filed by my grandfather, Ken Tilson. And then my mom was an organizer on Pine Ridge, who was Oglala Lakota, who was protecting trying to keep uranium from being developed on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, and then was part of the group that invited the American Indian Movement to come to Pine Ridge, that led to the occupation of Wounded Knee in 1973, and that's where my parents met. My mother and father met in the midst of the revolution. So all of that just means I'm an AIM baby. I was born out of the love of the movement, literally. But I grew up in a family that was, the thing I appreciated about my parents, I guess, is that they both did the work of resisting and building at the same time. And that's very informative of how I think in the world and how I developed the theory of change for Indian Collective and how we're supporting Indigenous communities today, because one of the very first things that they did, which was one of the actual demands of the occupation of Wounded Knee in 1973, was they wanted to build a Native American owned and operated public radio station to keep tribal government accountable to the people. And so they actually went on to do that. They had no idea what they were doing. And they made it very clear that they had no idea what they were doing. But the people said, we wanted to create a radio station. And so they went on to create the very first Native American-owned and operated public radio station in America called Keeley Radio. And that sort of launched. Keeley in my language means cool. So we went on to sort of catalyze Indian radio throughout Indian country. And if you think about it, this was in the early 1980s, in which radio was the way in which the way movements were mobilized and how people, started building power and communication that was not just controlled by the government. And so I grew up in that regard, and so I got to be sort of a part of both of those worlds. I got to be part of a cultural and spiritual movement of reconnecting young people to culture and spirituality and identity on Pine Ridge. Sort of accidentally stumbled into doing community development with an organization called Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation that I founded. We also were a whole bunch of young people who had no idea what community development was or how to do it. But we know that our people needed housing, we needed food, we needed opportunities. And in the process of doing that work, we were organizers that were learning how to do community development. And in the process of doing that work, it sort of started kind of quasi-working, I would say. We became sort of Indian famous, as I like to say. Like, Indian country knows, but not anybody else. And in the process of doing that work, we were reached out to about 70 different tribes and communities throughout North America who say, we want to do what you're doing in Thunder Valley, but within the context of our own climate, culture, and spirit of our tribes and our communities. And at that time, I was like, well, we need to address something seriously if we're going to do that, because, in the field of philanthropy and impact investing, it seems that white supremacy and racism is pretty prevalent. And we need to shift money and decision-making power back into the hands of impacted people, and in our case, indigenous people. And so we built the Indian Collective. We went to the drawing board and said, we're going to build an organization that does grant making, or we're going to, in a short period of time, we're going to become the biggest grant maker of indigenous people in the history of philanthropy. And, here we are sort of 48 months later, we accomplished that. We raised over $100 million. And the other thing is, the other part of that is we've moved that money. We're not sitting on that money. We moved over $22 million so far to over 524 Native communities who are doing work across the board, from frontline activism work that you see happening in the work of defending, developing, and decolonizing, to developing regenerative and inclusive economies based in indigenous values. So this has sort of been part of my journey, and I think that one of the big things is that we really believe in this really, really simple concept that when you arm indigenous people with the resources needed to architect their own future, they can make amazing things happen. And they can build a world that's not just and equitable for Native communities, but for everybody in Mother Earth. And we believe that's our theory of change. And we're in I would say that we're an organization who's, 4 years old almost, but I think indigenous people have been proving that point for thousands of years.
So, but what's different about this moment that you were able to attract those kinds of funds, at this moment in history? What do you think's come together that make, because you're not the first one to say, let's put some money into these communities, so let's make something different happen. So what's different now, or what are some of the pieces that enabled you collectively to be able to attract those kinds of funds? But again, and then to put it back out there, right? But what's different now? What happened?
Well, I think there's a couple things. I mean, I think we created the structure of Indian Collective prior to the current political moment, right? So we created a structure that was organic, that came out of the Indigenous Peoples Movement, who basically recognized that we do have the resource, we do have the vehicles and mechanisms to move money, we have the experience to do it. We just actually have to move out of these white-led institutions. And I'll be honest, in 2018 and 2017, when I was going around, there was a lot of people who were like, "Oh, that's a good dream," and it just pissed me off. So I was like, "Well, we're gonna lean into that little, chip on the shoulder there," because here's the thing: what we did is we recognized philanthropy in this space as a power structure. And a power structure that has kept black and indigenous people out of these spaces, organized. It's been an organized fashion to keep us out of these spaces. And so what we did is we didn't deploy a fucking strategy. We employed a fucking organizing strategy. And so many of the folks at the beginning that were sort of saying, good luck, I hope this, good luck and all that. All of a sudden, 2020 happened, after the death of George Floyd, the uprising happened. And this political moment that we're in, we all have to acknowledge that this political moment that we are in was created by black feminine leadership. 100%. And we have to recognize that. And it's made us wake up as a country, wake up as a world. It's not just, and so that combined with what's happening with COVID and the disproportionate amount of impact, especially at the beginning. And I think that for us as indigenous people and the stands that we've been taking, we've been constantly saying, okay, how do we show up in solidarity with the Black Liberation Movement, but within the context of who we are as indigenous people? And to be quite honest, that's where this cross-intersection of Lineback and the Lineback movement has come from. It's a way for us to show up raw and authentically indigenous as how, saying this is what we want. We want our land back, we want to challenge these power structures, but we can do it. We believe in a future that includes black reparations and indigenous land back. We think that world is a pretty damn good world for everybody.
So in this work, you know, there's two pieces. You know, one is, you know, the projects, and one is the policy piece that I think is there. So just on the projects piece and the work that's actually emblematic of, you know, as you're looking strategically, you know, and what's going to actually be the levers to create the larger change towards the vision that we're talking about here. So what are some of the examples of some of those projects that you're investing in, because they're going to be the seeds for the larger change that we want to see? Can you give some examples?
Absolutely. So, and Indian Collective has a grant-making arm, we have a lending arm, we have an organizing and advocacy and a policy arm of the collective. And through this system, we've done everything from buying land in the path of pipelines and then return that land after we either won or lost those fights back to indigenous communities. We successfully purchased land in the path of the KXL pipeline. And of course, we know the history there. We shut down that pipeline and it was never built through our treaty territory. And then after we purchased that piece of land for the purposes of land defense, we did work with the Sichangu Lakota Oyate, which is the Rosebud Sioux tribe, to return that land and help them increase their land base. So there's things like that we've done. We're a big supporter of Native Conservancy, Duke Langer. Everybody in the Native Conservancy folks can raise their hands right here in the middle here. To support them in their work to build an indigenous-led cow industry that can help create regenerative solutions to protect the ocean, to fight climate change, to create jobs, to sustain a sustainable fishery and way of life up there. They're one of the examples. We've also both gave grants and loans to the Old Dakota Buffalo Project, led by Weasley Pond Little Elk, who's now at DOI.
Number two person in the department.
Number three, but yeah.
You go from the interior down, it's number three.
Yeah.
You go from the bureau down.
So what that project is pretty amazing. That project was about building regenerative food system for the Sichangu Lakota Oyate. We were able to invest early on in the Buffalo Project that they were doing there. They had a big vision to take 23,000 acres of land and start becoming run the biggest buffalo range project in the world, led by tribal people. And so early on, we were like, well, we don't have investment dollars yet, we got grant dollars. And so we started funding some of their solar valves so they could have the carrying capacity for buffalo in that case. And then just, I would say, probably about a month and a half ago or something, I got to be able to be there and experience where they brought, over 100 head of buffalo from the Wind Cave National Park and deployed them, and returned them back to the Sichangu Lakota Oyate people. And right now, that herd by springtime will be about 1,000 head. and it will provide food, jobs to some of the, you know, some of the people there in that territory. So these are the different things that we're investing into. A lot of it's food stuff, a lot of it's land-based. It's not your latest widget thing that's going to then, you know, make billions and billions of dollars, but a lot of the stuff we're investing into is very organic, land-based, changing power structure type of opportunities on the project side.
That's great. And so one of the pieces for the American Sustainable Business Network, you know, it's not long ago, we started a project called Businesses for Conservation and Climate Action. And the idea was that it was going to be an indigenous-led, initiative to recognize the connection between, climate action, conservation, but just economy and the like. And the projects that you mentioned and the people, from Wissahickon to the Elk and the Buffalo Project, to Dune and the team at Native Conservancy and the Kelp Project, over to the work of bringing in the Aleut people and the work that they're doing in the Bering Sea. It emerged the concept has become clear that what we needed also is the policy change. We need to change the rules. We need to understand and lift up ideas like co-management, right, where the tribes and nations, are stewarding, are caretaking, are creating reclaiming the land, creating jobs, creating well-being for the communities at the same time. But how do we support that at the policy level? So we've been working with the Department of Interior, with NOAA, with the Council on Economic Priorities, and bringing these forces together in a unified voice, right, really demonstrating what ASBN is about, and letting those stories sing, but into a framework that says, now we need the rules changed. Now we need the policies changed, so we can say, this is the way that we're going to run our economy. So what are the thoughts around co-management? What are the thoughts about other policies that we could be advancing collectively in order to make sure that this is not just about a few projects, but this is about the kind of shift that's needed for the long term?
I think that co-management of public lands in America and shifting that from the federal government to tribes is the way for the future. I think that the reality is all public lands in America were stolen indigenous lands in the first place. So, co-management is a mechanism it's a mechanism for land back. It's not the only way. There's multiple different ways to return indigenous lands, but this co-management is one of the fundamental ways to do it. And the opportunity is ripe for it, because the reality is indigenous people have been managing the land much better than the federal government for many, many years. Not just historically, right? So some people don't even realize the numbers right now. So there's 574 federally recognized tribes in America today. That number's right, Kim, right? She's our VP sitting up here in the front. There's 574 federally recognized tribes in America today. And of those 574 recognized tribes, they're currently managing about 56.2 million acres today. And that's some of the best managed land in the United States. If you take some of the other public lands, most of them have just been playgrounds for the transnational corporations, the mining companies, the oil and gas industry, who have just exploited those lands. And to be honest, the federal government has mismanaged their public lands, just like they've mismanaged their trust, responsibility, and relationship to indigenous people. And so us taking control of in the form of co-management is a mechanism to get that back. And what that looks like is, instead of paying the Forest Service and paying the Bureau of Land Management and paying the national grasslands, there's a mechanism to pay indigenous people for the management of our own lands. And so right now, almost 4 weeks ago at the Tribal Nations Summit, it was announced that some of the priorities of the Biden administration and the priorities of the Department of Interior and the USDA are to focus on co-management of public lands adjacent to tribal nations. And so what's happening is tribes throughout the whole country are moving in different directions to create mechanisms to enter into co-management agreements. And it's one of the things I'm working on, because like, I might carry this title, but back home I'm just a wild Oglala. And so back home I've been going from tribe to tribe to build something called the Osheti Shapoi Nation Land Trust, which will be made up of 16 different tribes, which will be an entity set up as a Section 17 federal charter to enter into co-management agreements for tribes. So we have to be able to have the legal mechanisms in place, but also Section 17 corporations, especially nonprofit ones, can take on donations and investments. And so one of the big roles that I've been saying that conservation needs to play is that the wave of the future is indigenous-led conservation. Which that means that resources that are currently being housed at mostly white-led conservation organizations, they need to move those resources out of those organizations into indigenous-led ones. And that means that people have to give up power. That means people got to address white fragility. That means people got to address, you know, racism and white supremacy in those institutions. Because in the same way that we're coming for the federal government for land back to indigenous people, like conservation groups, we're coming at you too. So,
yeah. I think you're at time. Yes, we're time for this moment. But I think it's time for this change. So watch and help us move co-management, help us move these initiatives that you've been hearing about now, because it is that collective power that's going to be able to make the shift, because we're doing it differently. We're doing it together. The voices are real. They're coming from, you know, the heart. They're coming from the history of what needs to happen now. And it's coming from the right sort of people, and many of whom are in this room, and many of whom are connected to the communities that are out there. This is our time to make this all happen. So thank you for all the incredible work.
Thank you, listeners, for joining us. And a special thank you to Nick Tilson and David Levine for joining us on today's episode of the Just and Sustainable Economy podcast. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a review. ASBN's vision is a sustainable economy that is stakeholder-driven, regenerative, just, and prosperous. Visit us at asbnetwork.org and consider joining the movement. I'm Isaac Graves. Thanks for listening.